Before we begin this third hour of the program, I have to say, as host of Issues, Etc., I'm just rightly proud of our audience, especially after that hour of open lines. An audience that I would put our audience up against any other audience in Christian radio. You bring up that subject of does the Bible require Christian parents to spank their kids in any other venue of Christian radio, and you would have gotten the answer, well, yes, especially because the culture says we can't. Our audience is able to discern what Scripture rightly teaches on these things and understand the real purpose of Christian discipline, being bringing our children to repentance and the forgiveness of sins at the cross. That was said so many times in the last hour. But also, they're able to understand that just because the culture says you can't doesn't mean Christians have to react with the knee-jerk reaction and go beyond what God's Word does teach and say, well, if the culture says we can't, then we must. Yeah, the culture is telling us you can't spank your kids. But that doesn't mean we go beyond what God's Word teaches. And I'm proud of you. You knew what the Bible said, and you didn't go past what the Bible said. You didn't add to it, regardless of what the culture is saying. Wesley Smith is our guest here for the first part of this hour. Just a few minutes of conversation with Wesley about the word games of big biotech. And then we'll be talking with Karen Malik about the link between abortion and breast cancer. And Phyllis Schlafly will round off this hour, and we'll be talking about the Federal Marriage Amendment and judicial activism. Wesley Smith is a regular guest. He's an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide. He's a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute and author of the forthcoming book, Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World. I'm looking forward to this book. He's written a recent column called Word Games. Wesley, welcome back.
Hi, Todd. How are you?
Very well. And you?
Pretty well. Thank you.
Wesley, you have written recently in this article, Word Games, about, I guess I'll call it a language barrier that has been purposefully erected by big biotech. Describe it to us.
Yeah, what's going on here is a tremendously important moral controversy and moral debate in the United States over human cloning, embryonic stem cell research, and other issues of biotechnology. And what I think the proponents of cloning and embryonic stem cell research are afraid of the most is that the American people will understand exactly what it is they want to do and what the moral consequences would be. So instead of having a candid debate in which, for example, they admit that when you clone human life, you're creating human life, a cloned embryo, which would be no different in the way it would develop as a natural embryo. And instead of calling it an embryo, they will call it something like an unfertilized egg, which is junk science. So what you are seeing is a lot of junk science in the promotion of an immoral agenda because they don't want the American people to feel they can have a right to participate in this debate because they won't understand what's really going on.
Now, you actually quote Dianne Feinstein, Senator Dianne Feinstein, in a testimony given on the floor of the United States Senate in support of legislation that would be a clone and kill bill, basically. Let's clone people. And then let's destroy the human embryo, let's kill the human embryo in order to harvest the stem cells. And she routinely uses the word egg instead of embryo, and she routinely, at the end of her comments, used the term, as you just said, unfertilized egg. Certainly, this is an intelligent woman. She knows the difference between a fertilized and an unfertilized egg, doesn't she?
Well, I would hope she would know the difference between an embryo and an egg. An egg is just a cell. Let me read it to your audience. This is on the Senate floor in 2002, and this is the bill she has joined in with Orrin Hatch, which is called a cloning ban, which actually explicitly legalizes human somatic cell nuclear transfer, which is the only act of cloning, and requires that the cloned embryo be destroyed after 14 days. But they call it a cloning ban, even though it's a specific cloning authorization. That just shows you how dishonest advocates for human cloning have become. And here's what she said on the Senate floor. The beauty of our legislation is that it would allow this most promising form of stem cell research. That's another thing they're doing, as we've discussed on this show. They're trying to confuse human cloning with stem cell research. Adult stem cell research is stem cell research, right? This most promising form of stem cell research, somatic cell nuclear transplantation, to be conducted on a human egg for up to 14 days only. Now, that is junk science. Somatic cell nuclear transfer is when you take a nucleus from, say, my skin cell, You put it where a nucleus used to be in an egg, and you zap it with electricity, and if it works because my skin cell has 46 chromosomes, it begins embryonic development. It doesn't take 14 days. What can last 14 days is the embryo that is created therefrom. So you can see how she's just creating a bunch of smoke and mirrors and flat-out lies. Then she says, 14 days only under strict standards of federal regulation. Yeah, right. I've got a bridge in the San Francisco Bay here I'd like to sell you if you think that regulation would be strict. The reason for this 14 days is to limit any research before the so-called primitive streak, and then I put in brackets, the beginning of the nervous system, close brackets, can take place over that egg. Todd, you can never have a primitive streak, which is the beginning of the nervous system, occur in an unfertilized egg. It occurs 14 days into embryonic development, okay? This stem cell research can only take place on an unfertilized egg. An unfertilized egg is not capable of becoming a human being. Well, yeah, that's true, but by human being, you know she means a baby. A cloned embryo is theoretically capable of becoming a baby. Therefore, we limit stem cell research to unfertilized eggs. That is a lie, that is obfuscation, and that is disrespectful of the legislative process and the American people because it isn't telling the truth.
No, Wesley, it strikes me as kind of wickedly clever here because she says unfertilized egg, and she would say, I think in response to your comments there, well, but that's not that human embryo, if that's what you want to call it, is not the product of sperm and egg. It's just an egg that we've zapped with electricity.
Well,
it's unfertilized.
It is a new embryo created asexually in the same way that Dolly the sheep was created asexually. Dolly the sheep was a sheep. And when Dolly the sheep was an embryo, she was a sheep embryo, created asexually through cloning instead of naturally through fertilization. We now have two ways of creating new mammalian life through the wonders of science. One is sexually, fertilization, and the other is asexually cloning, somatic cell nuclear transfer. You would not have to outlaw the implantation of an unfertilized egg, which her bill would do, if you could not end up with a baby after 9 months.
Another example you give here comes from a California vote, California Stem Cell Research and Cures Act. Tell us about it.
Well, I get to vote on this. The California Stem Cell Research and Cures Act is a constitutional amendment that will be on my ballot for the state constitution. It will give a specific constitutional right to engage in human somatic cell nuclear transfer. It will give a specific constitutional right to engage in embryonic stem cell research. It will fund this. It will set up like a regenerative medical institute funded by borrowed money. You know, I don't know if you all know it over in Missouri, but we here in California are broke. We are worse than broke. We are near bankruptcy. We have kids who can't get health care and senior citizens who have their services being cut, roads that can't be repaired, and they would fund this new research institute, which would also give out grants, by borrowing through bond measures $3 billion over 10 years. When you add in interest, at minimum, it's $6 billion, and if interest rates go up, it'll be more than that. So that's what's going to be on the ballot, and it's going to be fronted by somebody like Christopher Reeve, who will be talking about how this will lead to cures. And they don't even explain in the bill, frankly, what it is they want to do. And listen to this. This is directly from the bill. There is hereby established a right to conduct stem cell research, which includes research involving adult stem cells, cord blood stem cells, and by the way, those are the popular terms for those, and so they use those. Moreover, what they give with that one hand they take away because they give priority must be given in the Constitution to embryonic stem cell research and cloning. So this is all nonsense. Pluripotent stem cells, that's a scientific term, which means embryonic stem cells, and progenitor cells, which is another term for adult stem cells. Pluripotent stem cells may be derived from somatic cell nuclear transfer, that's cloning, or from surplus products of in vitro fertilization treatment. So they don't even call an embryo, they call it a product, when such products are donated under appropriate informed consent procedures. The term embryo doesn't even appear. The term cloning only appears to say they do not fund reproductive cloning. So they call cloning to make a baby cloning. They call cloning to make research SCNT, so people will think it doesn't authorize cloning when it actually creates a constitutional right to cloning. Again, today the Union of Concerned Scientists came out and accused the Bush administration of fudging science when that's the pot calling the kettle black. This is junk science, disrespectful of the American people, and in this case the California people, because they don't want us to be able to vote on this measure knowing what it says. They want us to be fooled into thinking it says something it doesn't say.
Wesley, finally, and with about a minute and a half to respond, why does Big Biotech and why do their supporters feel the need to play these word games?
Because if the American people knew what was happening, knew that we were talking about human cloning, knew that we were creating human life for the purpose of destroying it, knew that the research they want to conduct into how to create human clone embryos would be the very information needed to create clone babies, they would reject the agenda. So rather than allow that to happen, the big businesses and the scientific establishment, which, by the way, this is a power struggle, they have an ideological desire to be able to decide what can and can't be done in science. Our job as lay people, apparently, is to pay our tax money for it and shut up and let them do what they want. They don't want us to have a voice, and that's why they're trying to confuse people with this obfuscating language and sometimes outright lies.
You can read Wesley Smith's column on this very subject at his website, wesleyjsmith.com, wesleyjsmith.com. Look for the column called Word Games. Wesley Smith, thank you for being our guest.
Thank you, Todd. Talk to you again.
Wesley Smith is an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide. He's a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute, and he has authored a forthcoming book. We will have him on when this one comes out, called Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World. He's written that recent column called Word Games. Find it on his website, wesleyjsmith.com. Karen Malik is our guest here for the next few minutes. Karen is president of the Coalition on Abortion Breast Cancer, based in Palos Heights, Illinois, a regular guest on the program. We're going to talk about a new report in the British Journal of Cancer, drawing a link between breast cancer and abortion. Karen, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us about the new report in this British journal.
Well, a researcher by the name of Patrick Carroll conducted a study, and he took a snapshot of the population in Great Britain, and he found that the best predictor of English breast cancer trends is abortion. And more specifically, he found that nulliparous abortions, and these are abortions that take place before the birth of a first child, are very, very highly carcinogenic. That's when women have cancer-vulnerable breast tissue. Women are born with cancer-vulnerable breast tissue known as type 1 breast lobules, and then they mature at puberty, and they become type 2 breast lobules. These are a little more complex, but they're still cancer-vulnerable. And so women who have these abortions before first full-term pregnancy are doing it at the worst time in their lives. They don't get the cancer-resistant tissue until the third trimester of pregnancy, starting at 32 weeks of gestation, 32 weeks of pregnancy. That's when this breast tissue starts maturing into cancer-resistant tissue, and that process goes on until 40 weeks when the term is over, when the baby is delivered. But this British researcher found that the abortions before first full-term pregnancy are very strongly correlated with breast cancer trends in Great Britain. And interestingly, he also found that upper-class women have a much higher incidence for the disease, and they also have a much higher mortality rate. They're more likely to die of their disease. And that is very unusual because upper-class women are more likely to seek early detection. they have access to better health care because they have more money available to them, and yet they're more likely to die. And the reason offered by the researcher was that these are the women that are more likely to go out and get the abortions in order to delay that first full-term pregnancy. So they're doing it at the most carcinogenic period in their lives.
Now, one of the criticisms that's often leveled against the research that draws a link between abortion and breast cancer is so-called recall bias. What is that criticism that you're so familiar with? And does Carroll's research, this new research in the British Journal of Cancer and this presentation he made, does it suffer from the same kind of so-called bias?
It is free of any potential for recall bias. Recall bias is a hypothetical problem that our opponents have used to really disparage the abortion breast cancer research. It has been shown many times by a number of scientific teams to be non-existent in the abortion breast cancer research. But nevertheless, they persist in arguing that women either over-report their abortions. They argue on the one hand that breast cancer patients are just over-reporting abortions that they never really had, which is ridiculous. And two teams of researchers actually chastised one team of researchers that claimed to have found credible evidence of over-reporting. And because of that, that team of researchers withdrew their claim. So there aren't any scientists today who claim to have found credible evidence of recall bias. That was the first argument they made. Breast cancer patients are over-reporting their abortions. Now they've changed their argument a little bit, and now they say that it's the healthy women who are under-reporting their abortions, more so than the breast cancer patients, and so therefore you can't compare the two groups.
But just a second. Why would a healthy woman under-report, and why wouldn't the unhealthy woman also under-report?
That's true. And you would think that if a woman did not want to report her abortions, then she simply wouldn't join an abortion breast cancer study. Women are a little smarter than that. If they don't want to talk about their abortions with somebody who's interviewing them about it, they're simply not going to join a study like that. And there's actually a study where this was an American study, Mayhew Giangreco, published in 2003, where there was a very low response rate. In other words, many breast cancer patients refused to even participate in the study, and it was extremely low. And so as a result, they undercalculated the risk. The risk would have been much, much greater if they had an adequate response rate. But this is one of the techniques that they're using now to show no link. And so this is what many of the researchers want to come up with. This is what the abortion industry wants the researchers to come up with. And let's face it, with tobacco, we had the same type of problem with researchers who were manufacturing research that favored the tobacco industry. We're seeing the same kind of thing today with abortion.
Is that, to your way of thinking, the way we're going to look back on this when finally enough of the facts and the data are in evidence that it becomes undeniable? Will we look back on the link between abortion and breast cancer the same way, and the denials of that link, the same way that we look back upon the tobacco industry denying the link between smoking and lung cancer and other respiratory diseases?
Absolutely. When we had cases, Dr. David Kessler reported in his book, A Question of Intent, a few years ago, that there were many cases of corruption among the very top, the most highly respected cancer research facilities in this country. And he names names. He identifies the cancer research facilities that received funding from the tobacco industry. And that includes even the AMA. And the same month they received $10 million, they opposed efforts in Congress to warn the public about this. So absolutely, we're going to look back on it in the same way. And quite frankly, our opponents have no desire to tell women that abortion raises breast cancer risk. And that includes the feminists who head many of these breast cancer organizations. Men, some of them identify themselves as abortion activists, and they don't want this acknowledged. They won't even acknowledge the recognized breast cancer risk of abortion. And all of the cancer establishment already says that if you are childless, if you do not breastfeed, if you have a small family, and if you delay your first full-term pregnancy, that puts you at very high risk. And abortion does all of those things. It denies women opportunities to have larger families. It denies them opportunities to breastfeed and to have an early first full-term pregnancy. And it makes some women childless. Some women abort the only pregnancy that they will ever have. So there is no question that abortion causes breast cancer in that way. That's the recognized breast cancer risk of abortion. But yet still, our opponents in the cancer establishment will not say abortion causes breast cancer, even when they're talking about that first way that it does cause breast cancer.
Now, this question always comes up. We only have a minute before we have to go, but I always want to see this cleared up, and that question is, spontaneous miscarriage, does it carry the same risk for breast cancer that abortion does?
No, it doesn't. Most miscarriages do not, and the first trimester abortions, the first trimester miscarriages are not linked with increased breast cancer risk, and there's a very simple explanation for that. Our opponents know perfectly well that a woman who is destined to miscarry in the first trimester does not have those hormones at a high level. She does not have a high level of progesterone, which maintains the pregnancy, and estrogen, which is made from progesterone. So when progesterone goes down, then estrogen goes down, and she loses the pregnancy because it can't be maintained any longer. And if she's not overexposed to estrogen, then there's no risk because estrogen is what is the culprit. Estrogen overexposure is the culprit in the abortion breast cancer link. It is a recognized carcinogen.
Karen Malik, thank you so much for your time and bringing this new study to our attention. We hope to have you on soon, and as the research continues to show the link between abortion and breast cancer.
Well, you're welcome, and I'd just like to encourage people to go to our website at www.abortionbreastcancer.com for more information.
Karen Malik, thank you. She's president of the Coalition on Abortion Breast Cancer based in Palos Heights, Illinois. We'll be right back with Phyllis Schlafly.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The fascists of the 20th century have been dead for 60 years. But are their ideas, is their worldview still alive and well in the 21st century? How have the fascists' disregard for life, for truth, and for Orthodox Christianity survived into the postmodern era? Our Issues Etc. book of the month for July is called Modern Fascism, The Threat to the Judeo-Christian Worldview by Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. Jean Edward Veith. You can have Modern Fascism by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours. Their number, 1-800-325-3040. Or browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July, Modern Fascism. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org.
The Earth's not flat. Read God's Word.
Answers with Ken Ham, a well-known Bible conference speaker. Ken, I've heard non-Christians say that if we take the Bible literally, it teaches the earth is flat. So how do you answer them?
Actually, when you read the Bible, you find exactly the opposite. It teaches that the earth is round, a sphere hanging in space. In the book of Isaiah, for instance, we're told that God sitteth upon the circle of the earth. The earth is spherical. In the book of Job, we read that God stretcheth out the north over the empty place and hangs the earth upon nothing. Now, the word nothing really means nothing whatsoever. From these verses, we get the idea that the earth is a sphere that's suspended in space. Of course, this is precisely what's observed when astronauts look down at the earth from a space shuttle. So where'd people ever get the idea that the Bible teaches a flat earth? Well, usually they quote the verses from Isaiah and Revelation that talk about the four corners of the earth. But this phrase actually means four quarters, which means the divisions of geography into four quadrants or compass directions that we use ourselves today, north, south, east, and west. There's one thing we can say for sure. The psalmist was right when he wrote, "Thy word is true from the beginning."
Is the Bible also true about what it teaches concerning the age of the earth? Is the earth really young? Read our free booklet on evidence for a young earth when you log on to AnswersRadio.com. It's a free service of AnswersRadio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. Violence in the media can cause children to be violent in real life. A joint statement signed by the American Medical Association and five other professional organizations says, quote, "The conclusion of the public health community, based on over 30 years of research, is that viewing entertainment violence can lead to increases in aggressive behavior," end quote. Don't allow your children to watch violent TV shows or play violent video games. Remind your children that Jesus died on the cross so that His peace would fill our lives. With Jesus in our lives, there's no room for hatred, revenge, angry words, or violence of any kind, be it real or on the screen. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at cmli.org.
Hi, this is Todd Wilkin, inviting you to tune in for a special live broadcast of Issues Etc. this Saturday night at 7 on AM 850 KFUO. We'll be discussing Islam with Dr. Alvin Schmidt of Illinois College. We'll also be talking to Dr. David Adams of Concordia Seminary about creationism. So tune in and call in Saturday, July the 10th from 7 to 9 for a special live broadcast of Issues Etc. right here on AM 850 KFUO. Welcome back for the final 25 minutes of Issues Etc. today. Our guest for this last few minutes, Phyllis Schlafly, a regular guest here on Issues Etc. Phyllis is an attorney. She is president of Eagle Forum, and she's author of a new book, The Supremacists, Judicial Tyranny and How to Stop It. Phyllis Schlafly, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you so much, Todd. Always good to talk to you.
Now, you're joining us to talk about the Federal Marriage Amendment, but let's start our conversation talking about this judicial tyranny. What does it look like, and how did we get to the point where we need to amend the Constitution in order to safeguard marriage between a man and a woman?
Well, the problem we have is that activist judges are legislating from the bench and trying to remake our culture through court order. And it's all happened in the last 50 years. There's been this growing idea, a bad notion, an unconstitutional notion that has been promoted by the legal community that the Constitution is whatever the Supreme Court says it is and that whatever some judge says is the law of the land. So we have this situation in Massachusetts where a 4-3 decision of the state court, state Massachusetts court, threw out the Massachusetts constitutional definition of marriage and ordered same-sex marriage licenses. And now you have these public officials standing around with their thumbs in their mouths saying, oh, yes, well, I don't believe in same-sex marriage, but if the court says that, we have to do it. And I think that's ridiculous. I agree with President Bush, who says in his stump speech going around the country, we will not stand for judges legislating from the bench or trying to remake America through court order. They have no authority to do that. The Massachusetts Constitution, for example, was written by John Adams and adopted in 1780. And any idea that John Adams wrote anything in the Constitution that could possibly be construed as authorizing same-sex marriage is positively absurd. So what we have is activist judges or supremacist judges, that is, judges who believe in judicial supremacy and that they can override the wishes of the legislature, the Congress, the state legislatures, the president, and the wishes of the American people and just impose their judicial fiat. And it's very unfortunate that people think that the only way to deal with this is a constitutional amendment. I support a constitutional amendment, but meanwhile, what Congress ought to do is to take away the power of the courts, the jurisdiction of the courts, to redefine marriage. Do we believe in self-government or don't we? Why should a 4-3 decision of some state court upset what the overwhelming majority of the American people want to be the definition of marriage, which we've had for hundreds of years? We shouldn't tolerate that type of tyranny.
It seems, Phyllis, that the whole issue that we're talking about here with gay marriage came upon us suddenly, but you chronicle a half century of judicial activism and legislation from the bench. Tell us a little bit, but give us a brief history lesson on how this has grown up and now coming to a head in our country.
Well, this history is summarized in my new book called The Supremacists, which is just out this week. Basically, it was little by little, with the judges asserting that they alone had the right to tell us what the Constitution means, and then the Congress and the American people just acquiescing in that, because we are a law-abiding people. But what they've done is to replace the rule of law with the rule of judges. And little by little, it was more and more. And in recent years, the judges have even been calling on foreign courts. For example, when it comes to marriage, what the people who are trying to give us same-sex marriage licenses are relying on is the Supreme Court decision in the Lawrence v. Texas case. And that was the case where the Supreme Court threw out the Texas sodomy law. Now, Justice Kennedy wrote that decision. He couldn't find anything in the U.S. Constitution that authorized him to throw it out, so he relied on foreign sources, a foreign brief, a foreign court, and what people in other countries are doing. And I think that is totally outrageous. Every one of those justices has put up his right hand and swore an oath to defend and respect the United States Constitution. And as a result of the court saying that the state legislature no longer has the right to set any standards of morality and to prohibit homosexual sodomy, which is what the Texas law did, you now have all these legal authorities around the country who say, oh, the next thing the court is going to do is to declare the Defense of Marriage Act, which we call DOMA, unconstitutional. Now, the Defense of Marriage Act, which we call DOMA, was passed in 1996 by overwhelming bipartisan majorities. It was signed by President Clinton. It says that marriage means a man and a woman as husband and wife. And then it has another section that, in layman's language, says, basically, if one state goes off the deep end on this issue, the other 49 states don't have to pay any attention to it. Now, it is a good law. It is completely constitutional. But I can tell you from talking, I testified at a Judiciary Committee hearing just 2 weeks ago, and I can tell you that all the lawyers are saying that based on the Lawrence sodomy decision, the courts are going to declare DOMA unconstitutional. Now, after DOMA was passed by Congress, it really authorized the states to set up their own barriers to same-sex marriage. And as you know, Missouri will have a proposition on the ballot in the August primary to put into our Constitution that we believe marriage is a union of a man and a woman as husband and wife. And we certainly hope that will pass and go into our Constitution. And it is the right, if you believe in self-government, it is the right of the people to establish this, and not the right of some judge to throw it out. This is what we mean by judicial supremacy, when the judge overrides the wishes of the American people, overrides what our elected representatives do in the state legislatures or in Congress. And I agree with President Bush, who said we will not stand for it.
We're talking with Phyllis Schlafly about the Federal Marriage Amendment. She has authored a new book, The Supremacist, Judicial Tyranny, and How to Stop It. You can read an excerpt of that book on the website for the publishing house, Spence Publishing. Their website is www.spencepublishing.com. They also have a toll-free number, 1-888-SPENPUB. That's 1-888-SPENPUB. The book by Phyllis is called The Supremacist, Judicial Tyranny, and How to Stop It. Phyllis, what is the proper role of the courts then? I'm thinking about the situation, say, in the era of slavery, where if you would have polled, if you could have polled the majority of Americans, you might have got a majority of Americans either ambivalent or in favor of slavery. But the courts did have to step in at one point and say, no, slavery cannot continue as a legal institution. What is the proper role of the courts today?
But the court did step in and said slavery can continue. And that was their supremacist decision in the famous case we call Dred Scott. This started right down here at the courthouse, right down on the Mississippi River in St. Louis. And it was one of the most unfortunate supremacist decisions in the history of the court. And the people who believe in judicial supremacy don't like to tell you that was the real source of this judicial supremacy. But that's where it started, and it played a role in precipitating the Civil War, and then the other case where the court upheld segregation in Plessy versus Ferguson. So if you subscribe to judicial supremacy, you've got to swallow the Dred Scott case and the Plessy v. Ferguson case, which upheld segregation. It took us a lot to override and get rid of those bad decisions. They were bad supremacist decisions.
So what is the proper role? Give us a primer as an
attorney. The proper role is like a baseball umpire. Now, you know, Todd, we got to have umpires in baseball games. We need them. They're good people. We need them to call the balls and the strikes. We need them to call the close plays. But you know we would not tolerate an umpire who called a batter out after two strikes. It's just not tolerable. The umpire cannot change the rules of the game. And that is exactly the proper role of the judges. They cannot amend the Constitution. They cannot change the Constitution or rewrite it or add sections. We have a process for amending the Constitution, and the court is not part of that process.
When the American people are polled on the issue of same-sex marriage, they are overwhelmingly against it. They want nothing to do with it. And as you pointed out earlier in our conversation, even the most liberal of our politicians will at least give lip service to it, saying we don't want a gay marriage. They'll always opt for some kind of other option. So how is it that the judges have decided, like in the case of Massachusetts, this is going to happen in that state when they know full well that it is not the will of the people?
Well, I think it's because they're a bunch of marshmallows. You've got the governor and the Speaker of the House standing around saying, oh, we're against same-sex marriage. But they won't take the action that they need. And Massachusetts, for example, has a provision that the legislature can simply fire the judges. They don't even have to go through the agony of impeachment. They can simply fire those four judges who voted and tried to force same-sex marriage on Massachusetts. But they don't have the will to do it. And I don't know what happened to the courage of the men who fought at Bunker Hill and Concord and Lexington, because the founding fathers, in their wisdom, gave us the tools to deal with all of these problems. And Congress, for example, has absolutely the power to decide what cases the federal courts can hear and not hear. And they ought to pass a law saying the courts cannot hear a challenge to the Defense of Marriage Act, DOMA. And that is what I talk about in my new book, The Supremacist, which describes this issue, what's the matter with it, and shows the remedies. And the remedy is right there. Congress must act. But I can tell you, having been down there to talk to the congressman and been down to testify, that they aren't going to move off a dime unless they hear loud and clear from the grassroots, because the legal community has got them so intimidated into believing that any judge who makes some ruling like same-sex marriage or take down the Christmas tree in the town square, or remove the Ten Commandments, or ban under God and the Pledge of Allegiance, oh, that's the law of the land. Well, we should not tolerate that. And it's up to Congress to pass the legislation that is necessary to curb the courts. And my book, The Supremacist, is a tool for plain people who are not lawyers to understand this issue and to understand the remedies. A lot of people complain about the courts, but my book, The Supremacist, has the remedies. It tells you specifically what Congress can do.
We're talking with Phyllis Schlafly about the Federal Marriage Amendment and judicial activism here in the last 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. Phyllis is a regular guest here on the program, an attorney and president of Eagle Forum. She mentioned there her book, The Supremacist. It's brand new, Judicial Tyranny and How to Stop It. I'm imagining the person who says, look, it seems inconsistent for conservatives to be pro-states' rights most of the time, but then when Massachusetts, a state, an individual state, through its courts, says, okay, we're going to have gay marriage, suddenly they're not so pro-states' rights anymore. Your response?
Yes, I don't think that's a valid complaint at all, because it is first of all Massachusetts' problem to deal with this issue. And as I said, I think they're a bunch of marshmallows for not dealing with it. Do you remember that several years ago, the state of Hawaii and the state of Alaska both had this same problem, where their court said that they had to give same-sex marriage licenses. And in both cases, the people of those states rose up and took care of the problem. In Hawaii, they passed a constitutional amendment, and I think that's exactly what they did in Alaska, too. They passed a state constitutional amendment that said marriage is a man and a woman, is husband and wife. And that is what Massachusetts should have done. Now, what we call on Congress to do, Congress can't write the Massachusetts law, but Congress can have the say-so about what marriage means when you deal with federal law. And that is very important in two particular areas, others too, but two important ones, which are the income tax code and the Social Security system. And they both depend on the proper definition of marriage. You all know that husband and wife can file a joint income tax return. Now, under federal law and under the Defense of Marriage Act that I just described, the income tax internal revenue should not accept any pseudo so-called marriage of a man and a man, because that does not comply with federal law. And that is what the federal government can do. Likewise, in Social Security, Social Security is a very pro-marriage, pro-woman organization, because it has widows' benefits, is the most wives live longer than husbands, and the Social Security system is designed to keep paying a little pension to the widow. And same-sex unions are not entitled to this. We are entitled as a people to say that marriage is a fundamental institution of our society. We need it for a stable society. We need it for the care and upbringing of children. And we are entitled to benefit marriage in the laws.
Phyllis, respond, if you would, to the argument that's made very often when it comes to gay marriage, that this is a civil rights issue, and if we continue the legacy of the civil rights movement and good court decisions on the part with regard to civil rights, it is natural then for the courts to allow gay marriage, or to do what they're doing now, and that is basically legislate from the bench to see to it that we have gay marriage legal.
Well, anyone who says that is automatically saying they want the courts to override our legislatures. And we believe in government by our elected representatives. We do not believe in judicial fiat, judicial supremacy, rule by judges. And anybody who makes that argument is saying, I can't go to the legislature because the legislature won't pass it, so I'm going to try to get some supremacist judge to do it. And it's based on the faulty premise that everybody should be treated equally. We don't treat everybody equally in this country. And your prime example of that is the income tax code. People are treated in very different ways in the income tax system because we think it is right and proper for good and sound reasons to treat people, differently. And we do believe that marriage holds a particular position in our society. We are entitled to preference it in the income tax law, in the Social Security law, and in our whole respect for a stable society. Now, nobody's stopping the gays from going and checking up and living any way they want. What they are demanding is that the rest of us accept and respect what they're doing. And they are invading our rights because we do not accept that.
Phyllis, I'm picturing a scenario in my mind, and tell me if this is if I'm completely wrong here. Congress does what you are urging them to do, because you're basically saying here, if Congress did its job, then we wouldn't need a federal marriage amendment to the U.S. Constitution. So Congress does what it's supposed to do, and they rule DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, off limits for reconsideration by the U.S. Supreme Court. They do that. Can't someone challenge that congressional activity before the Supreme Court and say, look, the law they passed ruling DOMA off limits is unconstitutional?
Well, anybody can make any claim he wants, but when I gave my testimony a couple of weeks ago to the Judiciary Committee, I outlined a long list of ways that Congress has taken away jurisdiction from the court, and that has been upheld and respected by the court. It's just a tremendous and uncontroverted record. And most recently was just about a year ago when Senator Tom Daschle of South Dakota got Congress to pass a law. It is the law saying that the federal courts have no jurisdiction to hear any cases about brush clearing in South Dakota. Now, I submit to you, marriage is more important than brush clearing in South Dakota. And that's just one example. There are features of the Medicare law, of the immigration laws, of all kinds of laws where Congress has withdrawn jurisdiction and said that the federal courts cannot hear cases about it, and the courts respect that because they know that federal courts have only the jurisdiction that Congress chooses to give it. That is what it says in the Constitution, and we respect the Constitution.
Phyllis, with only about a minute and a half before
Well, I'll give that number again for your listeners.
I certainly will, but I got one more question for you. Let's lay out two things. One, in the minute and a half left to us. One, the timeline for the federal marriage amendment, where it stands right now, and then if you could persuade Congress to do what it needs to do, how that would not be necessary. Make your case here in a minute and a half.
Well, I would support any way of defending marriage. I think this is the basic issue of our time. And I do think we can walk and chew gum at the same time. So I would urge Congress, yes, vote yes on the marriage amendment. Vote yes on the Hostetler bill to say that the federal courts cannot hear any challenge to the Defense of Marriage Act. Vote yes on a number of other of these bills. There's the Shelby bill to say Congress the courts cannot hear a challenge to the acknowledgement of God in the Pledge of Allegiance or the Ten Commandments. And Congress needs to step up to the plate and do its duty to curb the court and restore the power of Congress and of our elected representatives to legislate for our people. As President Bush said, we will not stand for courts legislating from the bench and trying to remake the culture of America by court order.
Folks, you can purchase Phyllis Schlafly's new book, The Supremacist Judicial Tyranny and How to Stop It, by calling Spence Publishing at 1-888-SPEN-PUB. That's 1-888-SPENPUB. They also have a website where you can read an excerpt from The Supremacist, Phyllis Schlafly's new book. That is SpencePublishing.com. It's all one word, SpencePublishing.com. Phyllis, thank you for being our guest again on Issues, Etc.
Thank you so much, Todd.
Phyllis Schlafly is an attorney. She's president of Eagle Forum. The book, again, is called The Supremacist Judicial Tyranny and How to Stop It. Now, one must commend Phyllis for having all her ducks in a row on that conversation, answering the devil's advocate questions quite well. I don't think you need to pull in the whole issues of nativity scenes or prayer in school or God in the pledge to make your case that when it comes to marriage and how the well, judges are defining or forcing people to define marriage in a different way, I don't think you need to pull those other things in there to make the case. I think her case is strong enough on its own. It is sad, though. I agree with her. It's sad that we have to come to the point where we need to amend the Constitution to forestall this kind of judicial activism. But let's paint with the same brush on both sides. And let's be honest. If we deplore judicial activism when it comes to these kinds of issues, redefining marriage, which we ought to, then we should equally deplore, now we won't call it judicial activism in this case, but we should equally deplore when the judges may try and legislate from the bench in favor of something we like. If we really believe that, and her analogy is great, the analogy of the umpire at the baseball game, if we really believe that our judges at every level ought to simply be umpires at the baseball game, they can't change the rules, but they must call the balls and the strikes and call people out or safe, then let's let the judges do that even when they don't act according to what we want them to do. Hey, at least they're being the judges that they've been appointed to be, right? If we don't like judicial activism when it works against our values, we also should deplore it when it works for our values as well, just to be fair. Now, Saturday night, we've got a special live broadcast of Issues, Etc., beginning at 7 o'clock. We don't usually broadcast on Saturday nights, but there's a special live broadcast, 7 o'clock Saturday evening here on AM 850 KFUO. It's a two-hour broadcast from 7 to 9. The first hour, Dr. Alvin Schmidt on Islam and Christianity, The Great Divide. We'll also be talking about creationism with Dr. David Adams of Concordia Seminary in the second hour of that special Saturday night 7 to 9 broadcast here on AM 850 KFUO. Tune in and call in starting at 7 o'clock this coming Saturday night. We'll be giving away books to the best callers Saturday night beginning at 7, running until 9 with Dr. Alvin Schmidt and Dr. David Adams. Now, Sunday night on the program, this is something you don't want to miss either, folks, and I mean it. Did the solas of the Reformation come about when Luther and the other reformers put their heads together and came up with these bright ideas? Or were those solas, grace alone, faith alone, Christ alone, Scripture alone, already the teaching of the Church? And can we find them in the early Church Fathers? We'll be talking about early Church Fathers and the solas of the Reformation with Pastor Will Whedon of St. Paul Lutheran Church in Hamel, Illinois, Sunday night on Issues, Etc. That's from 10 to 11 on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis. Tomorrow on the program, fascism. We're going to be talking about modern fascism and fascism of history, Islamofascism, with the author of our Issues, Etc. book of the month for July, Dr. Gene Edward Veith. You can find out more about this book, Modern Fascism, The Threat to the Judeo-Christian Worldview, by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, or visiting our website, issuesetc.org. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.